This is The Hollywood Outsider, a weekly movie and television podcast with a new episode available every week at thehollywoodoutsider.com. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or your podcast app of choice. My name is Aaron Peterson. I'm going to be your host for a special episode of The Hollywood Outsider. As our loyal listeners know, every once in a while we'd like to bring you interviews with independent filmmakers to give you an insight into both what goes into getting their films made, as well as insight into the respective film itself. For this episode, we are talking to the director of The Lodgers, Brian O'Malley. It's 1920 in Ireland. A pair of twins, Rachel and Edward, share a weird existence in a really old, rundown family estate. Each night, there's an evil presence within their home that demands that they follow three simple rules. They must be in bed by midnight, they may not permit anyone to cross the threshold, or the gates, as it were, and if one of them tries to escape, the other one will suffer punishment for that escape. Of course, a troubled war veteran named Sean shows up, and then things get dicey. He falls for Rachel. Rachel starts to see the benefit of breaking a few rules, and her brother Edward starts to lose it. And then everything is at risk because the curse of damnation awaits. The Lodgers was really entertaining. I really enjoyed it. It's a good old-fashioned gothic horror film with a modern twist. There's a lot of subtext about children suffering for the sins of their family and their parents. Once you find out what the entirety of this curse is, it's very unsettling. The sound design is excellent. The atmosphere is immersive. It is a wonderfully done film. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. And it's going to hit select theaters and video on demand on February 23rd. So by the time you hear this, it should be available. So I sat down and talked to Brian O'Malley about making this film and what it is like to create a film, a gothic film, in this day and age. And especially what it was like to film at Loftus Hall, which is one of Ireland's most notoriously haunted houses. It's a really interesting conversation. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. Whether you've seen the movie or not, I think you will be entertained by this interview. But regardless, be sure to see the movie. We don't get many gothic horror movies these days, so I think if you're a fan of that genre or subgenre, it has a cool story and some cool visual representations that I think you guys are really going to enjoy. So be sure to check it out. And if you're a Game of Thrones fan, I swear, he cast everybody. He had Davos in the last movie that he did, Let Us Pray, and now he's got Lance Lannister and Walder Frey in this one. So I'm fully expecting Tyrion to show up in his next horror movie. Regardless, this is a great interview with an up-and-coming director that I'm really looking forward to what he brings us in the future. This is my interview with director Brian O'Malley of The Lodgers, now available in select theaters and on video on demand. Be sure to check it out. Here you go.
Hi, Aaron. How are you, man?
I'm doing wonderful. Where are you at today?
Good, yeah. Well, I'm here in Dublin, in Ireland. Where are you? What part of the world are you in?
Chicago. Getting ready for a film festival in Chicago.
Okay. Cool.
First thing I always ask anyone I talk to is, when did you know you wanted to be involved in filmmaking? Was there a specific moment?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. And mine's slightly unconventional. I had incredibly unrealistic notions when I was young of being a pop star. And I worked very hard with a bunch of mates to make a lot of music, which led to nothing. And so I found myself for about a year with no focus on what I wanted to do with my life. Once that sort of ridiculous and impossible dream had presented itself, the reality of which it presented itself. So I decided to do something far more achievable than become a film director. It took me like another 20 years after that. But to finally get to make a movie, I'd made a lot of TV commercials and music videos in between. But actually the film that made me want to do it, because I was studying foreign art, I was a sculptor, and I was interested in working in special effects on movies. And I, in fact, had set myself up to work on Alien Resurrection as a sculptor. Mm. But I was watching science fiction movies to try and, you know, because at that time CGI wasn't so big. Mm-hmm. I was young now, I was like 20 years old. I was watching Blade Runner a lot. And after about a month of watching Blade Runner every night, I sort of realized that I would really just rather be the guy making these kind of movies. And that was really when I decided I wanted to be a director.
That's a beautiful
story. So I gave up wanting to be a pop star to wanting to be a film director, which proved to possibly be, well, I wouldn't say harder, but certainly it took far longer than I anticipated. So.
Did you see Blade Runner 2049 then?
I did, yeah. Yeah, oh. I thought it was amazing. I loved it. My only gripe with it was I felt it was half an hour too long. And I'm not alone in that. But I thought it was pretty amazing. And in fact, when I went to see it the first time, I couldn't stop thinking about it for 3 days and I had to go again to get it out of my system. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I don't think it's as much of a masterpiece as the original movie is, but I think it's pretty amazing. Do you enjoy it?
I didn't love it as much as the original, yeah. But it was a beautifully shot film. There's no argument.
Yeah, it was pretty special.
Yeah,
it was pretty special. But I did think if it had been 30 minutes less, it would have moved more rapidly and it just would have carried you along a little bit better. And in fact, Ridley Scott said the same thing.
Yep. Getting on to The Lodger. So after Let Us Pray, you were looking for another horror film to build off of, and this is the script that spoke to you.
Yeah, well, I was looking for another movie to build off of, and I was aware that as I had gained a kind of unexpected value within horror, because, you know, when you're making a very low-budget movie, you don't really expect it to kind of break through. And Let Us Pray did on a small scale. It was a very popular film. It got a lot of attention. So I found myself with some horror credentials. So I knew that I'd be stupid not to try and cash in on them on the second film. Mm-hmm. But I was also conscious that I didn't want to become known as that type of director who did full-on violent horror, you know, gore movies. Mm-hmm. And whilst I enjoy making that type of stuff, I have a very broad interest in genre cinema. I love sci-fi is kind of my number one thing. I love westerns, particularly spaghetti westerns. I love thrillers. I love film noirs. And I love horror. And it's one of the genres I love. And I kind of was conscious that if I made another full-on violent action horror movie, then that's what I would become as a director. And I'd end up doing a third one of those. And it would be difficult to widen my scope as a director. So I consciously seeked out a film that could fall under the umbrella of horror, but which was something other than what I had already done. Mm-hmm. And The Lodgers came my way because the producers of A Tailored Film in Dublin, they'd already commissioned the script, and they were at a screening of Let Us Pray in Montreal, and it was kind of a fairly raucous occasion. The crowd were kind of shouting at the screen and stuff. No, I wasn't there, but apparently it was great fun. And after that, they asked me, would I be interested in reading The Lodgers? It was kind of exactly what I was looking for, because it falls under the umbrella of horror, but it's a different thing altogether. It's less about the horror side of it, more about the psychological side of it and the subtle undertones that lie beneath. And that's very much a part of horror that I'm really drawn to.
Well, and it was written by David Turpin, who's got a PhD in English literature. He specializes in supernatural themes and modernist poetry, and he's also scoring the film. So how did that come about? How did you have the writer end up scoring, being part of the score?
Yeah, well, he's actually now Dr. David Turpin, believe it or not. He's gone even further than that, right? Because he was just Professor David Turpin when he wrote it, you know. But now he's Dr. David Turpin, and he's only like 34 years of age. But wow. So basically, David is in Ireland, is a minor sort of indie obscure pop star. And he goes by the name of the late David Turpin, it's a name he coined when he was in an accident that nearly took his life. And he decided, to use that to his advantage and change his stage name to the late David Turpin, which is quite funny and gives you an insight into the sense of humor. So music for him is a very big part of his life. And when I started working on the film, he expressed an interest in doing the score. And music for me is a really integral part of the film and something I like to have quite a strong hand in how it plays out. So I went to see a concert David was putting on with a host of other performers, and it was one of the best concerts I've ever been to in my life. I was so amazed by it. I just thought, well, there's no way he's not going to produce something absolutely beautiful for this film, even though he hadn't actually scored the film before. Mm-hmm. So he teamed up with Stephen Shannon, who is kind of the producer he works with when he's recording music. And Stephen had done some films before, and between the two of them, they developed the score and they produced something which I think is really hauntingly beautiful. So it was a great experience.
Well, and the other notable fact is you filmed this partially at Loftus Hall, which is a notable haunted house in Ireland. So do you feel like that helped the authentic feel to your movie?
Yeah. Well, Loftus Hall is considered the most haunted house in Ireland, which I'm not sure how you quantify that, but it is. It is quite a remarkable house in that it has an actual genuine strange presence about it when you're inside it. So when you step across the threshold like David Bradley does in the film and meets his fate shortly afterwards, it actually does feel like you're traveling backwards through time and you're stepping into a time capsule, which is something I've never experienced before, because, you know, in Ireland we have Trinity College, which is like hundreds of years old, and you go in there and it's amazing. But because it's lived in on a daily basis, it feels like a kind of an ancient building within the modern world, whereas Loftus Hall feels like an ancient building within an ancient world. You feel like the air inside the house is as old as the bricks and mortar. So there's something very strangely evocative about being inside the house. And for example, when you walk up the staircase, it's got this beautiful big handrail, which you've seen in the film. And when you look at it, you can see it darkened over the years from the oils of the hands of the people that ran their hands up the stairs as they walked up, you know. And so this sense of presence of the people who lived there before, purely by virtue of the wonky floorboards or the discoloration in the banisters, handrail, etc. And when you're in the house, particularly at times when I was in certain rooms alone, you could really get a sense of the people who had passed through here and lived here. And even though I didn't personally have any spooky experiences, I could genuinely feel a sense of what had gone before, which is a very strange feeling I've never really had in an old building before.
Was there any trepidation from the cast or crew about filming in a supposedly haunted house?
Yeah, I think there's always that sense of, well, will we or won't we, you know, when everybody goes in. But when you're on a film set, there's quite a lot of people there. There's a lot of talk and a lot of movement, a lot of lights. So in that sort of closeted group around the camera shooting, you don't ever have a sense of that. But it's not until later in the evening when everybody's left and I might have to go up and look at a room being dressed or whatever, and you're walking back through the house that you get that sense. But what did happen while we were there is the caretaker of the house, his name is John. He was known as John Loftus. If he was working in the house late, and he would often not go home because why bother driving home when he could just sleep in the house? So he took to sleeping in the bed that we built in the master bedroom that's in the film. Because up until then, there was no bed in the house you could sleep in. And he said on the first night that he slept in the bed, and he's a total skeptic, he said he lay down on the pillow and moments later in the floor above him, he heard footsteps walking around the room in a circle, and they continued around above him for about 10 or 15 minutes until he eventually fell asleep. So that was quite a strange experience he had during the shoot.
Was that you just in the room above him, just walking around in a circle trying to get him in the mood?
No, that's the thing, because they have to lock up the place afterwards. He was the only person there. There was way there could have been anybody else because the gates and everything were locked, you know. So, of course, he may have actually fallen asleep and then dreamed this happened. Who knows?
Yeah, you never know.
But he claims it happened, so it's a good story, right?
Well, the film follows a twisted lineage between the twins, Rachel and Edward, and the curse they end up suffering. It's very much a gothic look and feel, a very atmospheric look and feel. So as well as the sound design and ghost whispers play kind of a part in that sense of dread. So what are the challenges for you as a filmmaker? Because you kind of, you're doing a different kind of horror than you did previously. What are the challenges to shooting a gothic horror film like this?
Yeah, okay. Well, firstly, what you're trying to do is impregnate every moment in the film with that gothic sense, that sense of dread. And it's kind of easier in some ways than others. So obviously in the house, it's already very gothic looking. So we really did in there, apart from the magnificent dressing and production design Joe Folliver did to ensure each space worked the way we needed it. We had like a smoke machine ticking along all day long so that the air was thick. It was always cutting, you know, cutting through the air, and the light would cut through the blinds and stuff. It was much more of a challenge once you moved out of the house, because you're in a forest. Well, how do you make it spooky? And we bought a smoke machine, and you know, on our limited budget, we didn't maybe have the best one ever. So that was quite hard to get the smoke in shot every time we wanted. And then in the village again, I wanted to fill the village with smoke so that there was always this oppressive sense of, you know, that it was maybe some chimneys being lit nearby, and there was a sense of this kind of heaviness in the air. But that proved impossible on our budget. So it was actually, the further you moved away from the house, the more difficult it became to retain that gothic atmosphere. So then you're relying on grading and wardrobe and stuff to bring a little bit of that sort of colder, dourer look into the non-Loftus Hall scenes. But the biggest challenge of the film was the underwater sequence, which was shot in two swimming pools over 4 days. So we shot for 2 days in a shallow swimming pool where we did all of our close-up shots of people's faces and hands and all that type of stuff. And I was in very warm pools. So it was very easy for the cast to work in there, and they could just pop their head up and we'd direct them. We then had to go into a much deeper pool when we had to shoot the multiples of all the ghosts, which you see in the climax. Mm-hmm. And that was like three meters deep, I think, maybe even five actually at some points, because we had to drop the pool to get wider shots. And it was quite a cold pool. So that was very, very difficult for the cast. Franklin, who was our underwater cameraman for that section, he had a system where he could speak to the cast from above water, and it really helped calm them, and he could direct them very clearly. But the big challenge, of course, is when you shoot underwater, it's at least four times slower than shooting above water. So firstly, you have to storyboard it meticulously, because you can't just turn up and go, well, let's see what happens, because nothing will happen. You have to know exactly what you're going to shoot, and then that what you're going to shoot has to be scheduled, you know, a strict schedule that you can follow throughout the course of the day. So I storyboarded up all the underwater sequences, and then I cut them in half, and then I cut them again until all that was left in the storyboard was the bare essentials to tell that story, and anything else was to be considered a bonus. So we stuck by our schedule and we got every shot done, but it was an immense pressure, and we had an awful lot to do. And I think we managed to do about 15 shots per day, which for an underwater shoot is actually quite a lot, believe it or not. And over the course of the 4 days, we managed to get what we need for the water sequence, which isn't just the climax at the end. It's also all the shots of the ghosts over the lake, and then the dream sequence right. When they're floating up at the top of the stairs. That was all shot underwater. So we had all of that, quite a lot to do in 4 days. And because Rachel and Sean, when we see them as spirits, are multiple generations of the same people, we had to shoot Bill and Charlotte over and over again for every camera angle. So each setup became six different takes of each setup to move Bill and Charlotte into six different positions, you know. So it was quite a challenge, but I think the end result turned out pretty well, considering how little money we had and how tight everything was.
You brought up Charlotte and Bill, and they are the prominent factors of the film as the brother and sister, the twins. So how did you know Charlotte and Bill were the right fit for what you needed to do throughout the course of the film?
Yeah, okay. Well, Bill I'd seen in a film years ago called Son of Rambo. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah, I have.
He made that when he was about 10 years of age. Yeah, brilliant film. He's a little Quaker boy in that film. Mm-hmm. And my family are big fans of that. So I've watched that film a lot. I'd say maybe 20 times I've seen that film. And I always thought he was fabulous. So when we were doing this, I just, for some reason, he popped into my head, and I thought, I wonder how old he is now. And he was 21, so he was just about the right age. And I knew from his acting as a kid, he would be great. So I had no real concerns. And then Charlotte was discovered by one of our producers through the Rec films. She was in one of those, and she called her in for casting. And I just met both of them individually, and they were both brilliant. And Charlotte, actually, when she turned up physically, she's very brown-skinned and has white blonde hair. And I thought, well, she's not going to be right for this. But her performance was so outstanding and captivating that I quickly realized that it wasn't going to take that much to turn her into what we needed her to be physically. And I consider myself very lucky, because I think she's terrific in the film. She's absolutely brilliant.
Yes, she was.
They were an absolute pleasure to work with, and they got on like a house on fire.
You're going to have the rest of the Game of Thrones cast in your next film? Because I feel like each movie you have.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Well, I had Liam in the last one. Yeah. Liam Cunningham. And then David Bradley and Simon, or Eugene Simon in this one, yeah. So, but you know what? I could spend the rest of my life making movies and not get through the Game of Thrones cast. So.
That's true.
Who knows?
Well, I got to let you go. What's next for you? Do you have a project in mind?
Yeah, I have. Well, having, despite what I said earlier, I am connected to a Gothic horror movie, which is a really interesting sort of a supernatural mystery that's a bit like Shutter Island meets, I don't know, The Woman in Black or something like that. So it's really cool. And then I'm also developing a science fiction film with the writer of The Lodgers, David Turpin, which is in very early stages, but we're very excited about it.
That's Dr. Turpin now, right?
You're right, Dr. Turpin, the late Dr. Turpin, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, and I wish you the best of luck on the release.
It was a great film. Chatting to you. Thanks for taking the time. You're very good.
There you go, guys. That was my interview with director Brian O'Malley of The Lodgers. Once again, it is available in select theaters and video on demand as of February 23rd, so probably by the time you listen to this. Be sure to check it out. It's an independent film, but it's well done. It's well told. I think you guys will enjoy it if you are a fan of Gothic horror films. The acting is impeccable. The sound design is impeccable. The atmosphere is very slick. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. I've already said that a couple times. That's enough of that. Once again, thank you for listening to the Hollywood Outsider Podcast. We try to bring you interviews with independent filmmakers from the world of independent cinema when we can. So I really hope you enjoyed this one. Be sure to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. Our normal show has a new episode every single week and is available at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Once again, this is Aaron Peterson reminding you that the next time you head into the theater or sit comfortably on your couch and watch The Lodgers, buy popcorn.